7. Dead Man Walking. Fallout from a Double Murder, 2004 to 2007. Andrew Hodson had a weird feeling on the morning of Sunday, the 16th of May, 2004. When he drove past his parents' place, the garage door was down. Big night, he assumed. He returned later that day, a side stop on his way to buy cigarettes. Sister Mandy's car was already there. Drawn by her shriek, he rushed into the TV room. He touched his mother and father, who were stone cold. He whispered their names over and over. Mandy would later recall the scene in sepia tones. On her way in, she had seen her father through the window, lying on the floor, and had thought he was playing a joke. When she found them, she went straight into the kitchen and snorted a line of cocaine to steady herself. Terry and Christine did not expect to be ambushed the way they were. Drinks lay undisturbed on a stand. Christine wore pink moccasins, Terry tracky dacks. Both were found to have drugs in their systems. Terry had a cigarette locked between his stiffened fingers and a spent bullet cartridge on the back of his head. Mandy now believes her mother was shot first so that her father would suffer from the knowledge in his final moments. Over lines of coke, the Hodson family had chatted about the September 2003 burglary soon after it took place. Mandy would tell Dowsley and Carlyon that she punched her father when she heard what he'd done. "I just looked Dad straight in the face and said, 'You and Dave still went through with it even after Dale called at the 11th hour and said he had a dinner party?' I said to him, 'Oh, yous are fucked.'" Her father had broken his own rule: don't let greed into the equation. Internal investigators had wanted the family in witness protection. The youngest child, Nikki, nursing a baby, had railed against upending her life. She wouldn't do it. Her stance still haunts her. Her father had opted against witness protection because he wanted the family together. Andrew Hodson's first phone call when he saw the bodies was to Gobbo. She gave him Inspector Peter DeSanto's number. "Fucking Dale's done it," he told DeSanto. DeSanto was told that his boss, Assistant Commissioner Simon Overland, did not want him to attend the crime scene. Overland feared the media would see DeSanto and link the murder to police corruption. DeSanto fought the order and braved the chaos of cops and media. Andrew Hodson didn't care about TV cameras. He sobbed as he crossed the road to embrace DeSanto. Detective Senior Sergeant Charlie Bezina spotted the joint in the ashtray, the bodies side by side. He got to the hidden chemicals and the missing 45-caliber pistol later. The Hodson's murder had been a methodical hit. There was no upturned furniture, no signs of struggle. Even the gold straw Terry Hodson used to snort cocaine sat in its usual place. There were conflicting theories about the point of entry. Scuff marks on a trellis suggested the murderer had taken his victims by surprise. But nothing showed a home break-in, feeding the belief that Terry Hodson knew his killer. The neatness of the kills reduced the number of possible suspects to a handful. Hodson had broadcast his upgraded security to the underworld. He had organized it himself, including two German shepherds and a homemade CCTV system. One night, in the lead-up to the killings, a bottle was hurled down the Hodson's driveway. Of more concern, a security sensor had been tampered with. "Murray, it's started. I'm a dead man walking," Hodson had told Murray Gregor from the Ethical Standards Department, ESD, when the detective inspected the sensor. Police wanted the Hodsons safe, but they didn't want to have to spend money setting up surveillance to protect them. Some believed that their tight-assed approach helped get the Hodsons killed, and that they should have done far more. The failing brought into question Victoria Police's ability to protect other witnesses and informers. The police found the dogs beaten and locked in the garage, and the videotape of the premises had gone missing, presumably pocketed by the killer. Bezina was appalled by the ESD's lack of care for Hodson's safety. He told ESD officers at the crime scene that the inadequate protections were a clusterfuck. Paul Dale firmed up as a suspect at once. He had been charged over the Dublin Street burglary 6 months earlier. Now the star witness in the case against him was dead. Bezina arrested Dale at his Coburg home the following morning, Monday at dawn. Dale explained that dozens could vouch for his whereabouts over the previous couple of days. He'd been in Bendigo on a blokey weekend. Gobbo later said she had declined his invitation to attend. Dale was precise with details, and Bezina wondered if he was over-alibied. Williams later alleged that he arranged for Dale to deliver the $150,000 payment to a wheelie bin at the home of Williams's mother, Barbara. Williams spoke to killer for hire, Rodney Collins, 3 days after the Hodson deaths. They correctly suspected Williams's phone was bugged. In what police took to be code, Collins boasted that he loved cold weather because it kept the gigs, witnesses, away. He had said something had been overlooked, taken to be a reference to the surveillance cameras he discovered after entering the Hodson property. At his home on Monday morning, Victorian Premier Steve Brax was apprised of the shocking incident, as he would publicly call the Hodson killings. Brax's confidence in his police force was shaken, he later wrote in his autobiography, A Premier's State. Two people killed in police protection, possibly by a dirty cop. Brax asked bureaucrats to prepare for a royal commission. Gangland killings were a political bedsore in a state where law and order always featured highly on the list of election priorities. Just under a year earlier, Jason Moran's and Pasquale Barbaro's deaths in front of children had shifted underworld excesses onto Main Street. The Hodson killings were treated as gangland-related deaths numbers 11 and 12 in the short period since. Victoria Police had briefed Brax's Department of Premier and Cabinet by the afternoon. Brax was struck by their foresight. It had not been conveyed to them that Brax was considering a royal commission, yet police had already prepared their arguments against launching one. Just like the aftermath of the Jason Moran murder, Chief Commissioner Nixon knew the current moment was crucial. Amid the tragedy and the jibes about police corruption lay possibilities. Overland, her right-hand man, had helped set up the Australian Crime Commission, ACC, a coercive forum with extraordinary powers to question witnesses, just before coming to Victoria Police. That experience inspired their thinking when they went to their political masters with a list of requests within weeks of the Hodson killings. The pair laid out a blueprint that would eventually lead to gangland arrests and a new police culture condemned for its lack of transparency. After listening to their ideas, Brax opted against a royal commission. Instead, he created the Office of Police Integrity, OPI, an independent body for investigating police officers. As Nixon would note in Fair Cop, like the ACC, it wielded coercive powers, that is, the authority to compel witnesses, usually in secret, to answer questions and to tell no one. So did another new coercive body set up to tackle organised crime. The Office of the Chief Examiner, OCE. It was able to unravel the tangled links binding the main players in Melbourne's underworld by forcing them to provide information under threat of perjury or contempt. ACC, OPI and OCE examinations would often run parallel to police murder or drug investigations. And all these examinations have inspired questions about the appropriate separation of authority. Both the OPI and the OCE would be dubbed Star Chambers, a term that harks back to the 15th century Royal English Court of the same name, which came to be known for its secret sessions without a jury and the arbitrary use and abuse of power. The OPI was formally established in November 2004. Its deputy commissioner, Graham Ashton, was the son of a butcher and a former Australian Federal Police colleague of Overland. He would conduct many of the secret interviews himself, and as early as 2004, he was asking questions about the links between Nicola Gobbo and the Hodson killings. Not only had Nixon avoided a royal commission, she had also won more resources for gangland investigations and the legislative power to seize assets, which would yield about $60 million from gangland figures over subsequent years. Had I just become an immeasurably powerful woman, or a hugely burdened one? She wondered in her autobiography. What she did not do at this time was dedicate a task force to solving the Hodson murders. It's odd that the official investigation was left with Bezina and his on-call homicide squad crew, given both the ESD and Piranha boasted intelligence that was critical to the case. Under Bezina's control, the Hodson investigation had to be slotted in around whatever other unexplained deaths occurred in Victoria. Murder investigations are not always as they are depicted on TV. Interviews accumulate, yielding little information. Suspects are eliminated. Enthusiasm sags. Bezina's investigation of the Hodson murders gradually turned into a box-ticking procedure, as difficult crimes often are. Bezina was reduced to figuring out what did not happen in an attempt to isolate what did. He interviewed Dale only once, the morning after the murders, because he lacked the relevant information to question him further. Weekly briefings with command slowed to monthly meetings. He interviewed Nicola Gobbo a few months after the killings. He treated the chat as a mere formality, he would tell Dalsley and Carlyon in 2018. By then, he barely remembered the encounter. Gobbo was brash in her responses, despite her initial displeasure that the interview was being video recorded. She sounded offhand, as if she had somewhere else to be. She was performing. Sure, she knew Terry Hodson was an informer, she said to Bezina. Tony Mockbell had told her in 2002. Yes, she had told criminals this fact before his death. Hodson himself had had no idea that his life was being jeopardized by unguarded courtroom chatter. As a lawyer who used burner phones and had close connections with Tony Mockbell, Gobbo had a lot to hide. She employed the same tactic of deflection with Bezina that she would later use with many others, including Dalsley. She told him she had tired of criminal law and Tony Mockbell, who used her. She deliberately threw Bezina bait to seek to steer his professional gaze elsewhere. The talk of Melbourne was that her other client, Andrew Hodson, had been involved in his parents' deaths, Gobbo explained. Something to do with a missing gun, crime scene tampering, and the apparent lack of resistance from Terry and Christine. One has to ask how someone would get in there, she said knowingly. She explained how father and son had fallen out after Tony Mockbell showed Andrew written evidence that Terry was informing. Andrew was considered a hothead who had motive. She was deliberately misleading the investigators. She falsely stated she had had dinner with Andrew on the night his parents died. Bezina and his crew would spend years probing Andrew in a wasted effort, in part because Gobbo sent them down the wrong rabbit hole. 4 years later, in July and August 2007, Gobbo's dodgy past involvement with the Hodsons finally bit back. She was called to appear as a witness at a secret OPI inquiry into the Hodson killings, headed by Tony Fitzgerald, QC. A witness statement from Carl Williams had named police officer Paul Dale as the Hodson killer, and sparked a fresh and secretive police investigation. Fitzgerald was already across the case. In 2005, he had looked into the theft of the blue file for the OPI. Gobbo stood to confront serious questions she had deftly avoided for 3 years. Understandably, she panicked. The chaos of yesterday was feeding the chaos of tomorrow. By this point, Gobbo was officially informing to police for her third stint. An OPI examination could expose her informer history to the underworld. She was only ever one successful subpoena away from a bullet. Gobbo's handlers spitballed scenarios to protect their golden goose. She spoke of walking out of the hearing if dangerous questions arose. But she couldn't. Uncooperative witnesses at OPI hearings could be jailed on the spot. Police discussions went as high as Assistant Commissioner Overland. He gave his assurance that the OPI would be made aware of her status and presumably would spare her questions that revealed her informer role. Plausible deniability worked well with the crooks, but lying under oath is a crime. Gobbo had a problem in the OPI witness box. Within minutes, she was asked which police officers she knew. If she listed her specialized police handlers, it would be plain that she was an informer. She rushed from the hearing in tears to consult Piranha Head Detective Inspector Gavin Ryan, who was watching events on a camera in a nearby office. Soon, Fitzgerald was pointing out untruths in her evidence. Various of your relationships, particularly during that period, 2004, are of considerable interest, and you could expect to be asked more about aspects of those things, and you might think that you could be more forthcoming and more accurate than on the last occasion, Fitzgerald told Gobbo in an August 2007 sitting. In describing Gobbo's earlier evidence, he said, "I tell you that just as you took an oath on this occasion, you took an oath on the last occasion, and it's sufficient that I say I think that I believe that you neither told the whole truth and that indeed in some instances you told untruths." Despite Overland's assertion, it appears Fitzgerald was never informed about Gobbo's informer status. He told her in the hearing, "Do I think that you are, if charged, at risk? The answer's yes." Dates were touted for Gobbo to appear at another OPI hearing, but it did not take place. It's odd that a witness accused of lying under oath was not recalled. Gobbo was not charged with perjury. Her informing was not revealed. Why wasn't Gobbo held to account? The answer matters. Her insights into the Hodson killings and the extent of her possible involvement remain unknown to this day. By 2007, Bezina felt let down. He was a celebrated cop whose presence on the Hodson case had lent it gravitas. He had reported regularly to Overland. Yet he would tell Dowsley and Carlyon that his homicide investigation was window dressing that allowed other departments the latitude to pursue their own agendas. He believes to this day that Overland was running his own investigation behind his back. Perceptions persist that Bezina's investigation, unbeknownst to him, was an exercise in spin aimed at distracting focus from these other machinations. Harry Bosch, the fictional LA detective in the Michael Connelly series, has a name for the game-playing and Byzantine politics to which Bezina fell victim: High Jingo. This was something like Bezina's 150th case over 17 years in the homicide squad. It was, he would say in 2018, the clusterfuck that precipitated the end of his police career. Bezina and Overland fell out over the case. We, being the homicide team leaders, we were a thorn in Overland's side because we would stand up to him, Bezina would say in the witness box in 2019. In 2007, Overland ordered that Bezina be transferred out of the homicide squad to take a non-operational role. He quit this role after a week and took extended leave before retiring in 2009. He had been told by Overland, "I knew you wouldn't solve it." Overland was right. Bezina never had a chance. Too many Victoria police officers made certain of that. Vital clues about the Hodson murders were kept from him. Bezina did not know that his murder victim's lawyer, Nicola Gobbo, had been speaking on burner phones with his chief murder suspect, Paul Dale. In 2005, Bezina had waited for a call from the OPI's Tony Fitzgerald QC about the disappearance of Hodson's blue file. The call never came. Bezina was unaware of Dale's attempts to call Williams in the days before the Hodsons were killed, or the fact that the calls were taped. If this critical intelligence had been acted upon before the Hodson deaths, it's possible Terry and Christine could have been saved. And if Piranha had shared the tapes with Bezina, it might have cracked open the investigation within days. Instead, the tapes were given by Piranha to a subsequent task force, Petra, a full 3 years after the Hodson deaths. Nor did Bezina know that the Dublin Street drug house sitter, Abby Haynes, had been speaking to other police. Haynes's third statement would open up new possibilities in the increasingly vexed investigation. Haynes would say she was told beforehand that Terry Hodson would be killed. She worked for Adam Ahmed, who looked after the Dublin Street drug house for his boss, Tony Mockbell. Ahmed and Haynes had a casual sexual relationship in early 2004. They faced charges after the drug house burglary, but at the time of the Hodson's murders, both were out on bail and manufacturing ecstasy pills. In her statement, Haynes would say that 2 weeks before the killings, Adam told me that something was going to happen to Terence Hodson. Adam never mentioned Christine's name at all. I can't recall the exact words he used, but I was left in no doubt that there was an intention to kill Terence Hodson. They spoke about the same subject a day or two before the murders. Ahmed told Haynes to go out on the Saturday night. "He told me to make sure that I was seen by people," she would tell police. "I didn't ask Adam why he told me to be out. I suspected that he was telling me to be out and be seen because there was an intention to kill Terry Hodson that night." Late on the night of the murder, Haynes went to a nightclub in Albert Park. Ahmed called her after she got home, sometime after 2 a.m. Adam said, "You know what we talked about a little while ago? It's happened, or it's done." I can't remember his exact words, but it was words similar to that. For the record, Ahmed would deny Haynes's claims. He would explain that he had suspected Terry Hodson might be killed because it was obvious to me that he was working with police. Yet Haynes had no reason to lie in her statement. The revelation offered no benefit to her. If we assume, for a moment, that Haynes's statement was accurate, we can surmise that a circle of people knew of the impending murder of Terry Hodson. That group might have included Tony Mockbell and Carl Williams. Haynes said that Dale might have been on the take from Mockbell. The European, a criminal-turned-snitch who will feature in coming chapters, would tell police in 2005 that Mockbell paid $50,000 for Hodson's death on behalf of Dale. Dale therefore owed Mockbell big time. These claims are like so many others in an unsolved case. Speculations built on speculations. The question is, who told Ahmed the hit was about to take place? Was it Mockbell or Williams? Or was it Ahmed's lawyer, Nicola Gobbo? Facts overlooked until now support, but do not prove, the supposition that Gobbo knew Hodson's life was going to end. On the night of the 15th of May, when the murders took place, Nicola Gobbo was dining in Melbourne's Chinatown with Adam Ahmed. Did he talk about the $1.3 million worth of drugs and cash stolen from him by her other client, Terry Hodson? Did she talk about Hodson's hopes for a $1 million reward for snitching on his alleged Dublin Street burglary accomplices? Did the pair discuss the murders about to happen in Kew over honey chicken and fried rice?
You couldn't rule it out, a police investigator now says. It seems logical to me that it's a possibility that Gobbo had some cursory involvement. She was a fixer. She put people together to sort things out.
At the time of the murders, she was mostly fixing things for Tony Mockbell, but no one understood the toll Mockbell's demands were taking on her, or the unthinkable step she would soon take as a result.